Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. You want to give us a call, weigh in on the stories that we're going to cover today, 520-750-7456. Almost forgot what the number was. Okay, and as King Solomon says, we're here to give prudence to the simple, to the young man and women, knowledge and discretion. In Proverbs 4:5, he says, get wisdom, get understanding, do not forget or turn away from my words. Solomon makes a significant point here that we don't want to miss, and that is, do not forget. Just like I almost forgot the number there. We don't want to forget. There are times in our lives where we have the understanding and the wisdom he's referring to when he says, get these, get wisdom, get understanding. But if we forget them, they're not going to do us much good. The problem is, we're usually much better at forgetting than we are at remembering. I forget why, though. Actually, it's because we don't take the time to memorize things or remind ourselves in a way that we actually will remember. But Solomon gives us direction and wisdom there also. He says in a couple different verses referring to his commands he gives, to bind them on your fingers. Maybe that's where the idea of tying a string around your finger to remember something comes from. I'm not quite sure. I have to look into that one and see. And he also says to write them on the tablet of your heart. In other words, make them important enough in your life to remember them. And that's probably the real reason we have a tendency to forget things. We don't consider them to be an important thing to remember. We can easily remember those things that are important to us, though. You know what I'm talking about. Have you ever forgot your birthday, Oscar? No, I don't think so. Probably not, because it's important to you. If you're married, you don't forget your wife's birthday, nor do you forget your anniversary. But there's always been that stereotype of men supposedly forgetting their anniversaries.
Mine was Tuesday.
Was it?
Yeah. 2 years.
2 years. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
But see, I don't know of anybody that really would forget their anniversary, but there seems to be that stereotype. I never believed it. It didn't seem like it was, it made a lot of sense. And it's important, so you remember it. If you don't remember it, then you probably got a lot of bigger problems with your marriage than just forgetting things. What about the phrase absent-minded? Is that true? Makes it sound like your mind goes to school, and when the teacher takes attendance, your mind's not there, right? It's absent today. Well, what it really means is you've probably got something more important to you that's on your mind and that you're occupied with, at least for most people. I'm not so sure about teenage boys, though, after having raised two of them. I think there really is a tendency to be absolutely absent-minded there. But like I said, people don't forget what is important to them. When was the last time you forgot payday, right? I forgot today's payday. No, that doesn't happen. Yeah, right. You know exactly what day payday is. So what does it take to not forget? Well, like Solomon says, you got to write it on the tablets of your heart. Memorization is one way. It may not be glamorous, but it does work. That's how we learned our multiplication tables when I was a kid. I remember sitting there at the kitchen table with my mom, the deck of multiplication cards and the kitchen timer going. She'd set the timer and start flipping those cards out. You had to make sure you memorized them and get through the whole set before the timer went off. It worked. You know, phone numbers, you memorize those before the days of smartphones and cell phones. At least I did. I didn't like having that little black book to write things down, so too easy to lose. Keep it in your head. Can't lose it. Nowadays, we substitute our brain, it seems like, for a smartphone. You know. And as kids, did you ever forget Christmas? No, of course not. It was important to you. So one thing we don't want to forget, that next week is Veterans Day. We want to take the time to remember those who have served this country. I want to remember my grandfather, Gerald Harmer, Marine, served in World War II. He wasn't drafted. He volunteered when he didn't have to go. My brother, he served 20 years in the Navy. Thanks to both of them for their service to our country. Let us also not forget there's millions of people in far worse conditions than we have here in this country. When you consider the three countries hardest hit by Ebola, the Ebola crisis, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, 22 million people in those three countries alone. So I want to let everyone know that there is a nonprofit group here in town called Into Africa, IntoAfrica.org, that's raising funds to help people in those countries fight against the Ebola crisis there. They're putting together a team to ride in the El Tour against Ebola this year. So if you're interested in supporting them or riding with them, check them out, into-africa.org. So we want to be wise and not forget those in need. Because as Solomon says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and do not forget his commandments, for this is man's all. In our first story, Solomon reminds us in Proverbs 14:23, all hard work brings profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. We'll be back with that first story after this break. Okay, we're back here with Solomon on Blast today. Give us a call, 750-7456. I didn't forget it that time. So, all hard work brings profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. It seems Reverend Jesse Jackson is forgetting to apply Solomon's words, given that he is a reverend here. In this first story, Amazon, our favorite supplier of everything you need in life, Amazon, they are unclear on diversity, according to this New York Times story. Amazon, like most tech companies, is staffed and run mostly by white males, according to this story. The Seattle company disclosed recently in a lengthy page on its website titled Diversity at Amazon that its global workforce is 63% male, 37% female. Its managers are 75% male and 25% female. So in the United States, their workforce is 60% white, 15% black, 13% Asian, and 9% Hispanic. Managers are 75% white and 18% Asian, black, Hispanic, and other, more or less equally split the rest. Now, why is it that they're being asked this information, or why are they even putting this information out there? Well, diversity at tech companies has been a public issue for some time. The questions have accelerated, according to this article, since March, when our favorite person out there, at least some people's, the Rainbow Push Coalition, headed by none other than Reverend Jesse Jackson, challenged the companies in the tech industry in the Silicon Valley to reveal their racial and gender data. Now, is that really what he's after, Fred?
Well, I think they were probably looking at their own numbers recently, and you know what it takes to run their organization, and they realized there was probably some untapped wealth out on the West Coast.
So you're saying they're looking to put some people in place?
Yeah, you know, like
there.
Back in the 1800s, go west, young man, and seek your fortune. So
all that money sitting out there in Silicon Valley.
Who was that? Horace Greeley, I suppose, said that. So I guess Jesse Jackson must have been reading some history and saying, you know, there's some money to be made out west. So let's get out there and, you know, let's go to work on some of these diversity numbers. And the thing about it is, Doug, if you look at these numbers, and I'm not trying to play down the need for more diversity. I mean, I think everyone deserves a fair shot and. Whether it's affirmative action or the old boys network, that was an old form of affirmative action. That was a white version of it, you know, the old boys network.
But it was always the good old boys network.
The good old boys network. Yeah. However, nevertheless, these numbers, if you look at them probably across the board before all the other companies got shaken down, they're pretty good.
Yes.
Based on the pre-shakedown mode that they're in, you know.
Right.
So, here's another thing, you know, we're talking about this off air. It almost seems like the Asians don't rate when it comes to
being an
ethnic minority.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ironic because they certainly look like one in America.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to just compare the skin color issue, which is oftentimes the points that are being made constantly are about that.
Exactly.
People of color and whatnot. I mean, yet when it comes to these kinds of things, they don't seem to it doesn't seem to matter much to
it's background noise to them.
Yeah, exactly.
That here's a group that is a minority, but the numbers associated with them don't get brought up, don't get discussed and attacked, really, is what we're talking about here.
Well, have you ever seen the numbers at Cal Berkeley, for example?
No.
When it comes to qualifying minority students, they don't include Asians. They don't include East Indians, and they don't include, Pan-Asians. And for whatever reason, they've decided that their brown skin tone is not a factor in bringing in. And so,
right,
I mean,
diversity.
It's all ridiculous. You know, I'm trying to make it as absurd as I can. But, all of this basically is very much manufactured. The numbers, the demographics, all of these are manufactured for one purpose, and that's to get Amazon to dig into their wallets and give the Push Coalition some money, some cash.
Right, and it says here that by the end of the summer, most of those companies in the Silicon Valley had revealed all their racial and gender data, but Amazon never likes revealing data about anything to do with Amazon. And so it took some special urging by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who's the coalition founder and president. It says, Rainbow Push said Amazon's numbers were not as good as they appeared. I'm not sure exactly what that means. And criticized the company for a lack of candor. And so my question is,
I guess they
what right does Reverend Jesse Jackson what right does he have to make the decision as to what is right and wrong in a company's hiring practices?
It's nothing more than political leverage, and he knows that he's well connected to a certain party that will support him legislatively, that will support him government commission wise, and that he can do it. He's made a good living at it, Doug.
He absolutely has, and the Rainbow Push Coalition is making a lot of money. I actually went and looked at their website, the Rainbow Push Coalition website. I looked at their board of directors, and there's probably at least 30 people on the board of directors. My question to Reverend Jesse Jackson is, how diverse is that board of directors, sir?
Well, he reminds me of that old line, he set out to do good, and he's done very well indeed. So, here's another factor here that I thought was interesting. They don't mention the gay demographic at all. And there's probably a good reason for that, because when you're on the West Coast, just like we heard the CEO of Apple came out of the closet,
right?
The gays are probably highly represented
with respect
on the
to
West
their
Coast,
percentage in the
within
population.
These tech companies,
yeah,
with respect
definitely.
To the rest of the population. And so I guess they don't factor in this one as well. However, I was reminded the fact that even in Hollywood, though, speaking of feeling disenfranchised, even places like Hollywood, there was an article back in September that claimed a recent study says that Hollywood is not so gay friendly. And so even they're saying in Hollywood, now when I think about how does that measure up?
Yeah, how do you have
that would be kind of like gay on gay violence, I guess. How do you, even factor that? But I looked into this particular survey, and basically it was conducted by UCLA's LGBT think tank called the Williams Institute, and they just claim that lots of gay and lesbian actors feel disenfranchised, and they, felt that they feel that the directors didn't really want to work
with
them.
It's a feeling.
It was all based on feelings,
right?
And it was pretty astonishing that even got covered in the press. But I guess my point is everybody can feel this way. Yes, there are some real challenges in the workforce. But those challenges probably, in my opinion, are better met by simply, like you said, making better candidates and holding and challenging companies to look at these candidates. Like the National Football League does that. Mm-hmm. They have a minority hiring practice. Before they can just go out and hire, they have to look at a certain amount of candidates. And You know, I think that's fair because the National Football League has been, you know, especially when it comes to African Americans, have been completely promoted by the talent and the, you know, the accomplishments of this community. And I think it's fair for them to look at.
Yeah, and the thing that annoys me probably the most about this particular article, you know, Amazon is a huge company. They've done very well. This article says they have 150,000 employees right now, and that's up 36% in the last year. So here's a company that's actually growing at a very significant rate in a time frame when the rest of the economy is not doing well, as people are having a hard time finding jobs, and they're after somebody that's doing well, a company that's doing well, providing the needs in the economy. And the comment from the statement, I guess, that the Rainbow Push Coalition put out was their general workforce data seems intentionally deceptive, as the company did not include the race or gender breakout of their technical workforce. They just did an overall for the whole company. And then the statement is, the broad assumption is that and this is their assumption, the Rainbow Push Coalition assumption, is that a high percentage of their Black and Latino employees work in their warehouses. So they're upset about the fact that there are Black and Latinos working there, but they're working in the warehouses. And it just goes against the positiveness of a company like this in the country employing 150,000 people across the whole country. And here they are. It says they're seeking meetings with Amazon to pursue the matter. What is that? That's the shakedown?
Yeah, it's the cost of doing business today, where depending on what government is in power, you have to talk to these kind of people. And again, there's nothing wrong with opportunity. And I do think that America needs to examine some of those challenges and some of those glass ceilings. But unfortunately, it's people like this that tend to take the lead on these things. And it gives it a really bad feeling. Let me
right.
put it that
across
way.
The board, it gives it a very, very
you
bad
feel like
feeling.
The mafia is coming to the corner
exactly.
shop and threatening to break your windows, you know, if you don't.
And that's the implication here. What, Jesse didn't get his Prime membership free for Amazon so that he could get his 2-day shipping for free or something? It almost has that kind of implication, that what Jesse thinks is more important than what 150,000 employees having good jobs, company like this providing services throughout the entire country. There's large distribution centers everywhere. You think those people within those distribution centers are upset that they have a job with Amazon?
Yeah, something tells me that they worked really hard to get in the door. And again, I realize, you know, these corporations do need to be held accountable, because they will simply run roughshod over anybody. I mean, I think that's what the antitrust laws were all about back in the last turn of the century.
But I don't think they're going to specifically look for the bad employee and the white employee versus a good employee and somebody of a different color. I mean, nowadays, you want your company to do well. It's not about the color of skin. It's about their qualifications, and that should always be the way it is, and that's the way it was really presented by...
I mean, at the end of the day, Doug, you should know this. An engineer is an engineer, right?
Exactly. And just like a human is a human, it shouldn't matter what the color of their skin is, and that's really the appropriate approach. But Jesse Jackson seems to take it to the other side of the thing. It's always a race issue, and there's always something that he's not happy about when it comes down to that aspect of it.
Again, I think on their part, it's just a matter of looking for, like all these businesses, new markets to explore.
Yeah.
And he's found one.
He's found one that's got money. Hey, that he probably looks at the growth rates on some of these companies and said, all right, where's the money flowing? Right? Here's a company growing 36% in a bad economy, and the Rainbow Push Coalition needs some more funding for
Absolutely.
For the
board.
Time
to push out west.
So he says, let's go west and go where the money is. That's really what you got to follow. And I think that's what it's after.
The irony on the West Coast has been ahead of the curve with these kinds of things for really the longest time. And, you know, I originally come from the West Coast, and I will tell you, even growing up there in the late 60s as a small child, diversity was something that before it was a word and a policy, it was actually in play. I'm talking about it's been in play for over 40 years in reality, not based on all these government initiatives. It was simply in play. So, you know, it's time to get paid.
Yeah, so he's been at this all year long trying to promote his agenda for supporting his little company there. And like I said, when you look at the numbers on these companies, I'd say he needs to go look in his own house, in his own company there, the Rainbow Push Coalition, and see how diverse his numbers are with respect to race. And I would dare to say that you're going to find out that it's not quite where he's expecting these other companies to be. So we're going to take a break here at the half hour, and we'll come back with our second story here on Power Talk 1210, Solomon on Blast. Let me see. This one, in this next story, Solomon says, he who mistreats his father and chases away his mother is a son who causes shame and brings reproach. Well, we'll find out what that's all about after we come back from these commercial breaks. Give us a call, 750-7456. We'll be right back. So why would Solomon say, he who mistreats his father and chases away his mother is a son who causes shame and brings reproach? Well, in this story that I found here, it's about kids calling parents by their first names. They're ditching mom and dad and putting parents on a first name basis instead. What's the deal with this kind of trend going on here? I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, calling my parents anything other than mom and dad wasn't going to fly.
Well, in the article, it talks about a Marin County, California therapist, and you just have to say Marin County, and then it all makes sense.
And therapist, yeah.
But she told the Wall Street Journal, and actually this is right, she believes it's fallout from the era of overly permissive parenting. So basically, what she's saying, and I would have to agree, it's an abdication of authority on the part of a parent. It's much easier to be their friend than it is to be the bad guy that
right.
oversees the discipline and the structure.
And actually gets your kid mad at you because you won't let him do something that he shouldn't be doing anyways.
Right. You have to be all those things that you hated when you were a kid, and you have to represent that. You have to lecture them. You know, don't preach to me. Well, somebody better say something. And so by approaching the children with just on a first name basis, then it deformalizes the whole thing, and you can just be one of their friends borrowing their skinny jeans.
Yeah, if you can fit in them. Diana Kapp.
For some, it doesn't even matter.
Yeah. The author of the Wall Street Journal article told another Wall Street reporter, Tanya Rivero, that distracted parents are actually another reason of this name shift, that your kid's saying dad 14 times and you're not looking up, so they switch to your name, and then all of a sudden you actually look up. So some of it is that the parents aren't even paying attention.
Yeah, and some of the times it's just the kid trying to be cheeky and push the boundaries, as they point out, and call their parents by their first name with a little smirk. Just to kind of see, you know, it can be something that they're just doing to kind of assert their independence and see how far they can take it. But there is another issue here they don't touch, and that is, it must be pretty difficult keeping up with all the changing partners today. So let's say their mom has, you know, this is Uncle Jim, this is Uncle John, this is Uncle Frank. You know, they keep changing boyfriends. And so I'm sure they drop the uncle after a while because they catch on to the whole idea.
Right, she doesn't have that
many
brothers.
And so now suddenly mom's name changes to Jill or to Jenny as opposed to mom because, you know, they're living in the same crazy world and they actually lose respect.
Right. And
for their leadership.
Part of our confused culture is that they don't know who their mother and their father really are as things continually change. Like you say, from one day to the next, with the lack of focus on a permanent marriage and relationship.
Yeah, and you know, we use the word traditional, but I'm talking even resembling something traditional is even out the window, where they don't have a constant in place that they can call, that's mom, that's dad, and this is the way our family, you know, goes forward. So I think so much of that now is in flux, that it almost makes sense to call somebody by their first name.
And the other aspect that they didn't touch on here was what happens when you have the transgender that was once mom and then is now male. Do you go to dad or what?
Well, I mean, they have a little children's book called My Two Mommies. I remember that from a few years back and made kind of stir, so could have been kind of prophetic. But maybe in the sense that there's not two people called mommy, that you just call them by their first name, and I think you can avoid a lot of the
confusion
psychological confusion that way.
Yeah. So I think the other thing that kind of comes out is that there's only one person in your life that you can call mother or father. You can call anybody else by their first name, but typically there's only one that you can call mother or father, and the Bible does say that you're supposed to honor your mother and your father so that your days may be well with you. And when you don't take that approach and you have this feeling that it's just, oh, it's more of a friend thing or it's a casual thing, you lose that respect and that consideration that there is only one mother and one father that you have.
So you remove that, and what do you have?
Just another friend that you can call Pete.
We have Doug and Oscar.
Yeah. So it does bring up an interesting point. And like Solomon says, it's not always the best things for you. We want to not forget that mothers and fathers are important and that we should refer to them that way rather than by their first name. So I think I'd be in big trouble if I referred to my mom other than by mom. We'll be right back with our next segment here on Solomon on Blast after these quick commercial messages. Give us a call, 750-7456. In this next story, we're back, by the way. In this next story, Solomon says that we're to remember our Creator before the silver cord is loosed. Well, it seems like there's a group out there called the Sunday Assembly that don't want to specifically remember their Creator. You got that clip for us, Oscar? Or are we still having problems with the computer? No? Okay.
Today, listen to this. Sunday Assembly, or as it's better known, the Atheist Church, is launching 35 new services in cities across the world. There's ones in New Zealand, Hungary, France, the UK, and 16 here in the US. So I'm here at the one in Strongsville, Ohio, just outside Cleveland, and we're going to see what it's all about.
Nation's way of receiving you. Nation's way of treating you. Nature's way of telling you something's wrong.
What's your background? Were you raised in a religious family? Did you go to church?
I think I was saved twice, so it obviously didn't take.
You were saved twice?
Yeah, recently I've just been de-baptized, so I have the actual certificate.
Oh, really?
To show that I've been de-baptized.
How did you get de-baptized? Well, dry you excessively.
The central idea we need to spread is that we have only one life, which means that that life has to be lived to the fullest. There is no second chance, no opportunity to have a do. There is no afterlife in which wrongs are righted and cosmic justice meted out to the evildoers.
The Sunday Assembly was started by two British comedians, Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans. They held the first event in London in January 2013. After that, Jones and Evans found that people were getting in touch, asking if they could set up their own Sunday Assembly. What is it like being a now quite prominent atheist and organising something like this? Do you get any pushback from people who are religious that you know?
I do have several close friends who are religious. One of my best friends from high school, she is a pastor. I actually turned to my pastor friend to ask her, how do we start a church? And she gave me reams of advice, lots of great ideas.
So your pastor friend gave you advice on how to start a godless church.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, so that's what they are, a godless church. And as Solomon says, we're supposed to remember our Creator before the silver cord is loosed. It sounds like these people are just looking for a little community interaction, Fred.
Yeah, now, ironically, these guys are almost making a case on why people need to find a good church.
Absolutely.
Because even though they call themselves atheists, they crave the church experience. Why else would you do that? And like you said, you know, the Christian term is fellowship, Christian fellowship. And they are seeking a form of fellowship, well, community, small group community, connectedness. They're looking, just to hear the music, they're aping the charismatic worship service. It's pretty obvious what they were doing there. It's kind of ironic to me, Doug, when it comes to, you know, especially atheists in the West and America in the West, how they know exactly which God not to believe in, right?
Right. Now,
they know exactly which... you know,
it's not
ordinance
like
to disassociate themselves with, like baptism.
Right. He was debaptized.
He was debaptized, so they know exactly which
they're targeting
kind of music to invert.
Right. They're targeting a specific religion. They're not they're not really true atheists. So, I don't know how you would say they're atheists against God versus atheists against...
They absolutely know which God not to believe in.
Yeah.
Which is a left-handed compliment. It's almost an endorsement.
Well, what you didn't see, because it's obviously a video and this is radio, was that their meeting place was an old church. So they're pretty much everything there is about a church, but they leave out the most important part, which is God, because without him... Where's the power?
They even had preaching. They want to be exhorted. They want to be encouraged. They want someone to speak into their lives. And it actually, like I said, almost churches should almost adopt this and use it to say, this is why you need to come to church.
Yeah.
Because you're desperate. But here's the one thing that they're missing, which we know as Christians. The church in Scripture is the body of Christ.
Right.
And to have church without that reality would ultimately be a pretty desperate experience. I mean,
there's no hope. You heard the guy. He said, "This we only got one life. You got to make most of it here."
Yeah, absolutely. And all he's going to do is actually bum somebody out when they try to process
exactly.
through all those positive feelings. And when they come to the very end, see, even a you might say a really stimulating worship service as a Christian, at the end of that is not, it's not over. At the end of that, it's just starting. It's like, I have all this and God's grace beyond it.
And yeah,
it's not like this is all there is. Paul said if it wasn't for the resurrection of Christ, we of all men would be most miserable. So it's the living Savior that makes Christianity what it is.
Yeah, and one of the shirts that they had in the video, there was a slogan that reference doing good. So really what they are is just, like you say, a group of people trying to get together from a community aspect. Yeah, maybe they want to do good, in which case they're really looking at chopping the Ten Commandments in half, effectively. Get rid of the half that talks about God and just keep the half that talks about doing good things. And my question is, you know, if they're getting rid of God, why do they even have the belief that they have to do good?
Based on what authority?
Exactly. Whose authority? And what? How do they select who leads these churches? Is it just somebody that says, hey, you know, I need to have a not church today, and you people can come, and I'll talk to you and tell you whatever I believe.
Well, you know, and I'm not comparing them in terms of destructive, mentality, but the Church of Satan, for example,
right.
in San Francisco,
right.
that was a great article when Anton LaVey passed away, and the name of that article was The Church of Satan Goes to Hell. And it described how once Anton LaVey passed it, they just started fighting with each other over who would control the assets. And I'm afraid, ultimately, this is where they're going to go as well.
Yeah, and my question is, what do you tell your kids? Where are we going today? Well, we're going to Sunday Assembly. Well, why? Because we want to meet with other people, I guess. Right? At one point, the kids' questions would basically make you sound like you're doing something that's totally irrational.
And absurd.
Yeah. What's the real point here that they're trying to get across? And
well, let's face it. Same attitude is in your kids when you have people that go to a Christian church without the devotion and the personal lifestyle to back it up. I'm talking about on a regular basis. Your kids will ask the same question.
Right.
Why do we go to church?
And like we talked a little bit about last week, until they have that relationship, they're not going to continue once they get out on their own.
Yeah.
And when you look at it from a wisdom, knowledge, and understanding point of view, they're limited. They're limited to man's wisdom, knowledge, and understanding, not to God's. So not a lot of hope there in the Sunday Assembly. We'll be right back with our One Greater Than Solomon segment in honor of our veterans. I've got a little story here on a World War II veteran. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. In honor of the veterans out there for Veterans Day, I found this interesting story. World War II POW recounts the faith that sustained him. So in our One Greater Than Solomon segment, we honor Joseph Plappert. He was a U.S. Army soldier during World War II, and he fought in the Battle of the Bulge. Here's a little bit of his story. He says, is this it? He remembers thinking. He and another soldier had received word that that morning the Germans were coming and they would need to fortify their position in the Ardennes Forest in central Belgium. The 22-year-old soldier dug furiously into the frozen ground, throwing aside clumps of snow, ice, and other dirt to create a foxhole while another soldier watched the road with a bazooka. Run, run, the Germans are behind me and they're coming down, another soldier yelled, jumping out of his jeep before diving behind a nearby tree with a guy holding the bazooka. Plappert watched as the shell exploded the jeep. He dropped his shovel, glanced at the foxhole, realizing as he did that it wasn't going to hold him, and then dove for a nearby hedge. It was December 17, 1944, and thousands of Americans were fighting off Germans in one of World War II's bloodiest battles, the Battle of the Bulge. It was a day Plappert believes his life was spared for a reason. It was a day about 90 American prisoners of war were murdered by their German captors in the Malmedy massacre. In a story that he wrote, he says, I lay quietly in the winter snow. I watched intently as German Colonel Piper's armored tanks rolled down the road, the guns swung side to side, seeking enemy targets and firing nonstop into the surrounding fields as the vehicles moved forward. When I was lying there, they fired with a machine gun. Fortunately, because of the Lord's desire, they were about 3 feet to the right of me. I could see their tracers. I thought, phew, that was close. Plappert, now 85, said a lot of things went through his mind that morning, but as he watched the soldier behind the tree nearby lose a thumb and his false teeth after reeling from the concussion of a shell, he thought he should stay put in the cold snow rather than chance being caught by a stray bullet, shell, or German soldier. He says, I had my .45 in my hand thinking, if two guys come, do I shoot one or do I give up? I thought if I give up, they were just going to shoot me, so I said, oh, okay, at least you can get one. But thank you, Lord, nobody came. Hours later, he was startled and ready to shoot when he heard felt a hand grabbing his foot. To his relief, it was a wounded buddy crawling around to help, or crawling around for help. By that time, he said American artillery was returning fire, and he knew he needed to retreat and find help for his wounded friend. He says, "We have to make a run for the house," referencing a nearby farmhouse. "I know you're going to have trouble. We'll stand up. You'll grab hold of me. Hang on, and I'm going to run to the house." At the farmhouse, they learned three others had sheltered in the food-laden cellar. During the night, the men realized someone else was in the house shooting a rifle through a window. They heard the exchange of fire but didn't know whether Americans or Germans were upstairs. "So we didn't make a sound. We didn't know what the situation was," he said. Well, later that next day, he says they heard sounds of trucks and everything. He knew the Nazis were losing the war, and they were unable to supply their men, so they didn't know whether the trucks were American being driven by German soldiers or not. He says, so that they end up spending another night in the cellar of the house. But the next day, it wasn't the farmer who opened the door. They heard footsteps, German voices, and the cellar door flew open. He says, of course, that was it. So they made us come out, and these two guys took us out in front of the house on the porch and left four guards. The two guards were teens and two old men. They were all German, and since the Germans by that time had taken thousands of Americans and Allied forces as prisoners of war, the teens were pretty trigger happy. These kids wanted to shoot us. They wanted to shoot us in the worst way, he remembered, and these old men said, "No, you can't do it." That was the only thing that saved us, was those old men. And he says, we were ordered to line up in front of the farmhouse. Two of the soldiers were ready to shoot him, but Hitler, and especially because Hitler had ordered that any prisoners captured during this battle were to be shot. We were all aware of this possibility because everybody had spread the word amongst them. But in all, there were 30 GIs rounded up that day. We all stood there silently facing enemy guns, not knowing what would happen. But to our relief, we were loaded on trucks and driven a short distance to a nearby town. There, the soldiers were put in German ammunition depots. And in the midst of all that stuff, he said he could hear Americans shooting cannons. He says, that night as we tried to sleep, U.S. forces bombed the area. And he said the Germans would not have been disappointed if the building they were in had been destroyed. He remembers praying, "Lord, don't let a shell come through and hit this ammunition." And though he had left his gun belt, his .45, and a knife his father had given him in the cellar, he said they had to give up coats and boots and everything else, and despite the cold, it was one of the worst winters in history. He had nothing of value. But somehow, one of the German soldiers had failed to notice or weren't concerned with one of his most precious possessions, and that was a Gideon's New Testament under the flap of his chest pocket on his uniform. He says, I have no idea why it was not confiscated at that time. Some of the other POWs in our barn began to join us. Eventually, the group numbered up to 10. Initially, the guard would not allow us to form groups because they didn't want us to have opportunities to make plans of possible escape or to cause problems. But eventually, they conceded and allowed us to meet. In the months to follow, the young man who had grown up in Detroit and trusted the Lord when he was 16 looked for ways to encourage others by taking time for Bible study and prayer. And he says only a short time before that, as a new recruit, as he sat on his bunk reading his Bible before lights out, other soldiers threw shoes at him and teased him about it. But it wasn't so in the battle or after he was captured. So he survived the German POW camps and had made it back when the Americans came in. And we just want to say thank you to all those soldiers out there from World War II, Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq. We really do appreciate the sacrifice that they make. We have a special audio clip here, and I'll try and set it up for you real quick before we go into the final play out here. And that is, this is a group of U.S. Marines in an assembly hall, almost looks like a university center where you attend a class, tables, long lines of tables and chairs. All these U.S. Marines are standing behind the chairs, and they're all ready dressed, battle fatigues with their hydro pack camelbacks on, and they're all standing in this auditorium with music playing and the words to this song up on the screen. This is what we're going to leave you with. Remember, till next week, live wisely.